Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery. With your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back to the House of Mystery on KKNW 1150 AM Seattle. I'm Al Warren, and of course to the side is Kev Thompson.
Hey Al, here we are again.
Yeah, another day. Another beautiful day in the summer, and everything's great in the world.
Yes.
And here we are. So we've got some great shows coming up for everybody. In September, we're going to be covering the Kurt Cobain and his death, we'll call it, because there's a lot of people that are on the side of murder and not suicide. And we've got the chief of police for Seattle coming on live in September. And he was on the case, and he was the one that headed it at the time, and he has a lot to say about the latest controversy, so that'll be exciting. Looking forward to that.
You know, that's one of those mysteries that's going to go down in history, kind of like the JFK. Was it an assassination by, or was it, you know, nobody knows. No matter what evidence is presented, you've got your viewpoint.
Especially in Seattle there, you know, I can't believe how I get. This is one of those things I keep getting swayed back and forth on, and every time someone comes out with something, I kind of go one way and then I go the other. Now, you know, Courtney and I, of course, didn't get along when I talked to her, but I'm almost on her side on this one now. So we'll just leave it. That's all I'll say.
Yes, that's saying a lot.
Well, yes, because I'm certainly not a fan, but I'm sort of more on her side with a lot of the statements that came out. So we'll talk about that coming up shows. That'll be good. Now, today we're going back into the cult world, as we call it, kind of, religious groups. And, of course, we'll be covering all sorts of things this month as well. You know, we've got the Jim Jones thing and all that. But today we've got a great guest. I'm glad he could make it by Skype. It's Benjamin Zeller. He's a PhD, and he teaches religion in America. And we're going to talk about one of his books, and it was on Heaven's Gate. And that's kind of where we're focusing today. So thank you for being on the show, Benjamin Zeller.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, welcome.
Thank you.
Benjamin, let's fill the audience in on who you are, where you come from, and kind of what brought you into religion, so to speak.
Sure, sure. So I am a professor of religion. I teach at a small liberal arts college outside of Chicago. And what's important in terms of my study of the Heaven's Gate group is the suicides which ended the group, and most of your listeners probably remember the Heaven's Gate suicides, if they were alive, in 1997. Hale-Bopp comet was overhead. There were claims there was a UFO trailing it, and the entire membership of Heaven's Gate, all 39 people, committed mass suicide just outside of San Diego. So what's important for me is, at the time, I was a college student. It was my second or third year in university, and I was studying ancient religion, which had always fascinated me. And I was reading about the Epic of Gilgamesh and sort of ancient Egyptian beliefs about the end of the world and sort of, you know, the ancient mysteries. And then right before my eyes was a contemporary group where the same sort of things were unfolding. I had been learning about beliefs about end of the world 2,000 years ago. I had been reading about, learning about groups that believed in Messiah figures, Savior figures. And here, right in front of me, was a group with a self-proclaimed Messiah that believed the world was about to come to an end and committed suicide. And I began studying it as a college student even. And 20 years later or so, I'm still studying it. And the book came out really based on those decades of research starting in 1997.
That's amazing. Now, when you do that research, like in something like Heaven's Gate, you must find members of the groups or people that follow that belief system. What's it like trying to interview people like that? And I mean that in a sense of, are they willing to talk to you about how they got into it and what, how they lived?
Sure. I guess the first thing I would say is people are people. And I always approach any sort of interview with anyone, no matter what they believe or do or where they're from in life, as just another person to get to know and to hear their story. And I really try to convey that I respect their story. I may not agree with what they believe or what they do or did, but I want to try to understand it. So some of the ex-members I've spoken with, that I have interviewed several ex-members, you know, some of them are very wary to talk because they fear that they're going to be considered crazy or brainwashed. They're used to decades of people making fun of them and their co-religionists who committed suicide. So it's often very sensitive for them. When I've talked to family members, often that's very sensitive as well. You know, they lost a loved one, and they have very strong feelings about it. I really just try to recognize that this is a really complicated story, and I really just want to understand from each person's perspective what it is that they experienced and understood. But yeah, I've talked to plenty of ex-members.
How do they feel about what happened? Like now, I mean, because now that a lot of the group committed suicide and that whole thing, and it was all over the TVs and everything. How do they feel about that? Like, are they sorry they got into it, or
are they experiencing survivor's guilt?
It depends on the person. So the largest number of ex-members actually were only briefly part of the group in the 70s when they began. This is a group which began in the early 70s, 1972, 73, depending on how you count it. And there were people, several hundred people, who joined in the mid-70s and stayed no more than a year or two. And for them, this is often part of their ancient history. This is something they had done 20 or 40 years ago at this point, back in their younger days. And for those people, they often don't even think about it as Heaven's Gate, which it wasn't called at the time. It had a different name. And they don't think much about it. Maybe sort of it's a bit of trivia that they were part of a group which later evolved into the suicide movement. The people for whom it's much more a live issue are the relatively small number of people who were part of it in the 80s or 90s and left, no more than a couple dozen here and there. And some of them are still true believers. I mean, they really believe the message of Heaven's Gate. They just chose not to join their co-religionists in the suicides. Others don't believe the message, but they look at it as an important part of their life experience, that they learn something from it. Others look at it as a mistake. But it really depends on the person. But everyone's processed it in some way. I have not directly interviewed anyone who said, boy, I wish I had never been involved. Everyone I've spoken with has said that they learned something from it. They took something from it. But then again, the people who really wanted nothing to do with it also would not be answering my phone calls. So it's a bit of a catch-22 there. The people who hate it want nothing to do with it, by and large, don't want to talk to an academic who wants to interview them.
Yeah. So let's explain this. So the people that don't know, explain to them what the group Heaven's Gate was and what is it that they did.
Sure, yeah. So Heaven's Gate, and it used different names during its 20-year history or so, but we'll keep calling it Heaven's Gate. It began in the 70s, two founders, Marshall Herf Applewhite and Bonnie Lou Nettles. They were spiritual seekers, and they created a new religion that drew from beliefs in UFOs and ufology, government conspiracies to hide the existence of UFOs and extraterrestrial contact, with a sort of very Christian focus on the end of the world and reading the Book of Revelation and sort of prophetic books. They started in the 70s. They briefly hit national media in the late 70s when they convinced several dozen people to up and leave their families and join. This was in Waldport, Oregon, right down the road from you. About 20 or 30 people just up and left their families to join Heaven's Gate. Then they went underground. People really didn't hear much about them. They came up, you know, now and then. They had a satellite TV broadcast. They had a website, but most people hadn't heard of them until 1997, when the group decided that they had to flee our planet before it would be destroyed in order to go to what they called the next level, outer space, where they were hoping to get onto a UFO and then sail around and sort of take care of the galaxy, basically like extraterrestrial space angels, for lack of a better term. I'm sort of trying to summarize here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So think of it as sort of, it's a bit Christian, it's a bit New Age, it's a bit ufology, sort of all combined together, but it made sense to them.
Where does this come from, do you think? That, like, the idea of going somewhere and becoming, you know, guardians of the galaxy. where does that come from? Like, I'm just trying to picture, like, if someone approached me and said that they were a chosen one and that we've got to do this, we've got to, you know, do what they want it to do with Heaven's Gate. I'm trying to think how, I would just think the person was a nut.
I think that's a common reaction. But, you know, if you ever read the Bible or the Quran or the Bhagavad Gita, most of the great religious visionaries probably come across as somewhat nuts. You know, in terms of Heaven's Gate, and that is not to say that religions are nuts, just that if you're outside of the religion, it doesn't make sense. To them, it made sense because it was very much this idea of becoming an angel. You know, they're looking at this sort of long Christian history of the idea of heaven, and they're basically saying outer space is heaven, and they're basically saying the prophets were in communication with space aliens who they wrote about as God because they didn't have the language to talk about it, but that all the Bible is, or for that matter other religious texts, are recollections and memories and instructions from outer space, from the next level, about how to try to become a higher evolutionary creature, how to evolve out of our planet and to join them in outer space. That's the message in a nutshell. Now, would it make sense to you or me if we heard it on the streets? Probably not, but that's why this group only had about 40 people by the end.
Now, given the time, though, that they were beginning to develop in the early 70s when people were more open-minded or, you know, more, I don't know, planetary conscious, it would have made sense to that type of an audience.
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, when people today in, you know, the second decade of the 21st century, when unless they're part of sort of a particular subculture, when they hear about UFOs or flying saucers, they often think this is very, you know, fringe stuff. They forget that in the 70s, you know, this was a very much a live issue, and that it wasn't considered fringe or crazy to be a believer in extraterrestrial contact. That this was unsettled science, and I would say even today, much of it is unsettled science. But there's much more of a sort of a connotation that it's fringe or weird today than it was in the 70s. So yeah, there sort of the UFO side, the flying saucer side, really had very broad appeal in the 70s when they began.
Yeah, well, but for me here, hold on. I was going to say why I think it's a fringe is because Not so much. Like, if you say to me, okay, well, UFOs are the higher level and we should make contact. It's not that I don't believe that we can have contact with aliens or there could be people in other planets. But they have a whole elaborate story. You have someone coming to you telling you the story that the different types of aliens we have and what they're doing, what their plans are, where they live, and what they want us to do. That's the part that seems fringe to me.
Yeah, and that's what Heaven's Gate had. They had an elaborate story, an elaborate, really theological understanding about the nature of extraterrestrial life. There was both an angelology, which described the higher order, the angel-like beings, and there was a demonology, which described the lower order of space aliens. Those would be the reptilians and others who were up to no good, nefarious agents of evil here on Earth. So they really did have a very fleshed-out story and understanding, a theology, a worldview, to make sense of our planet and how it fit in with the rest of the planets in the universe.
So to really understand this, we would actually have to go back to the origin, and that would be Marshall Applewhite. What happened to this music teacher that one day he just woke up and he's like, I'm the Messiah, I have this vision. I mean, what happened?
It was a very slow process for Applewhite. So Applewhite was, as you said, a music teacher. He was actually the son of a Presbyterian preacher. He briefly attended, Applewhite Jr., so Marshall Herb Applewhite, briefly attended seminary, so he had some theological training. Then he dropped out to study music. His life was really falling apart when he met Bonnie Lou Nettles, who was the co-founder. Applewhite had been fired from his job, and there's different stories of what was going on. He was having these religious visions. He thought he was hearing voices. He thought he had some sort of religious mission, but he didn't know what it was. He was a bisexual, and he couldn't get any of his relationships to work, male or female, so he felt like he was at his wit's end. The dating pool was 100% for him, but he couldn't make anything work. He was divorced already. Living apart from his family. So really, he was at his wit's end. And Bonnie Lou Nettles, who he met in 1972, who was a theosophist and an astrologer, really introduced to him sort of a set of spiritual teachings to help make sense to him about what was going on in his life. And basically, what she helped him to understand, they believed, was that the reason his life had fallen apart is because he had a higher calling, that fate had destined the two of them to meet and to become spiritual partners and to develop a new something. They didn't know exactly what they were doing at first, just that they had a mission together and they had a higher calling. And this is really the beginning of Heaven's Gate. It's Applewhite and Nettles meeting and deciding that they are spiritual partners, that fate has destined them to do something together. And it did take them a while to figure out, as you said, the messianic claims. That took a while.
But it makes sense now. You can almost see where their beliefs came from. He had to somehow reconcile his Christian faith with his lifestyle, and she offered, you know, she was able to fill in the gaps. So they Frankensteined this belief system.
Yeah, she's often forgotten, Bonnie Lou Nettles, because she had died before the end. In 1985 is when she died. But she, as a theosophist, as a spiritualist, she was engaged in channeling. She was engaged in astrology. She was very deeply within sort of this metaphysical New Age worldview, and she introduced that to him. She claimed that she could communicate with extra-dimensional, extraterrestrial beings and that she could bring their messages to Earth. She claimed she could communicate with the dead. She claimed that she could perform astrology and chart the future. And that is really what, combined with his much more Christian, biblical set of understandings and assumptions, what fused to create Heaven's Gate. You can see why I'm still studying it 20 years later. And I have to say, there's still many mysteries and unanswered questions about the group.
I was going to say, now, they called themselves, they had new names for themselves too, right? It was Doe and T?
Yeah, but that was only the last of them. At first they called themselves Guinea and Pig, and is well, they were running a little experiment on themselves, they said. Yeah. And then it was Bo and Peep because they were trying to create a flock. And finally it was Tia and Do. You know, actually for a while they called themselves him and her. They were trying to figure it out. The whole idea there is they were giving their human identities. You know, the rough analog here would be if you were to become a Catholic nun or a monk, you would take a new name when you joined the monastery. So you'd become, Brother Francis or, Sister Claire, whatever it is. And that's your new name within the group, as a nun or a monk. But they were doing sort of the same thing. They took a new name because they were rejecting their old lives and personalities. But for them, it went further. They were rejecting our planet. So a monk or a nun is not rejecting our planet. They're just rejecting their birth name because they have this new identity. For Heaven's Gaiters, they were rejecting their humanity. So by taking new names, they were saying, I don't belong on this planet. I'm not going to use your earthly planetary name. I'm going to take a next level name, a next level meaning outer space.
Wow. Well, there you go, Al. We can become Bugs and Bunny.
Okay, I'm calling you the Bunny. Now, on this, now, what did they think? Like, okay, so the Heaven's Gate members believed that the planet Earth was about to be recycled or wiped clean or something like that, and they had to leave the planet immediately. So when that didn't happen, doesn't the current Heaven's Gate followers know that it's not true?
Well, there are very few current Heaven's Gate followers left. I mean, the group is gone. The group is defunct. There are a half dozen or so true believers who are left, and they have different understandings about what's going on. One of the misunderstandings about not just Heaven's Gate, but many apocalyptic groups, is they don't say the entire planet's going to be destroyed, just that our current civilization is going to collapse. So as I understand it, one way you can sort of repackage that is to say, well, our society is in the act of collapsing. It hasn't collapsed yet, but the end is coming. But most apocalyptic groups have to deal with this. The apocalyptic groups say the world is going to end, and it doesn't, as far as I know. And they have to deal with it. And in many cases, they keep going. The top example of this is the Seventh-day Adventists and other Adventist traditions, which said the world was going to end about four or five times back in the middle of the 19th century.
Yes.
And it didn't, and they're still here. And they have different explanations for that. The Jehovah's Witnesses, the same thing. The explanations are, well, it's beginning to end, or sort of the process is going to unfold, or it's been delayed somewhat, or we've done something to help push it back. There's different ways of reconciling this.
Well, look at Elizabeth Clare Prophet. I mean, she was giving definite dates, but they didn't have their bunker system ready yet. So God has given us a couple more months to finish it. Well, now it's still not done. So God's given us another couple of months. That got to the point to where people were losing faith right and left.
Well, I mean, this is a long-standing issue with any group with apocalyptic beliefs. Look at first-century Christianity. The Apostle Paul writes about how he doesn't expect that, or he expects that there are people living now who will see the end of the world. And he expects everything to come crashing down, and then what is the first, second, third generation of Christians going to do when the world doesn't end? Will they end up building a church and sort of shoving end-of-the-world beliefs into the literally the back end of their theology? It's the very last book in the Bible. You can be a Christian and not think at all about it because all of that apocalyptic stuff was sort of put in at the tail end. It's still there, but it's not a central part of Christian teaching as it emerges in the 3rd, 4th, 5th century. However, it's still there, and that's what we see today is we see apocalyptic groups that go back to this very ancient Christian set of beliefs about the end of the world, and which have never been expunged from the Bible. They're still there. It's in the book of Revelation. It's right there. And they reinvigorate it and say, now we live in this era. But it is tough to keep a group going if you're expecting the world to end at any moment.
Yeah. What is it about us, then? That have you figured any sort of way of understanding why we as humans always put ourselves in this place where there's always a group of people that are expecting the world to end, and it's always some sort of major catastrophe that's going to happen, and it keeps on reappearing in different religions, but or different belief systems, I'll say. And is it something in our human nature, do you think?
I think it is. It's a great question. So I'm conjecturing here, but I think that part of it has to do with this profound nostalgia many of us feel for the past, where we think of the past as the golden era and everything has declined since then. Actually, even that very phrasing came from antiquity, the idea that there once was a golden age and now we've descended down into there was a silver age and a bronze age and that things are going downhill. And if things are going downhill, well, that implies that eventually it's going to hit rock bottom and that's the end. You see it in Hinduism. It's very well developed in terms of the yuga system in Hinduism, that we're in Kali Yuga, which is the end, and that each yuga gets worse and worse, and we're reaching the end of the world. And in Hinduism, of course, it's cyclical. It will restart, and it'll start over again. In Christianity, it's more linear. But most religions have this, and I think it's rooted in this idea that things used to be better, and now they're worse, and they're going downhill. I'm not sure empirically if that's true. I would much rather live today than 100 years ago, for example, or 1,000 years ago. But I think psychologically...
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Technically, it's very appealing to people to say, well, we were great once. Let's be great again, so to speak.
Yeah.
<It's>, here recently.
Yeah. And, yeah, there's always, well, that ties into even modern day politics without getting into it, because...
You think?
Well, we want to make it great again, but then I always...
Across the left and the right. I mean, this utopian thinking of this idea that things were better once, and either embracing apocalypticism or utopianism. Those are your two options. Either say it's all going to end and we're looking forward to it, or we're going to make it better and we're going to try to build it. Those are your two options. And again, it's left-right, it's secular, religious. I think it's everywhere.
Yeah, it's everywhere. And that's what's kind of – it's just what your concept of what great was and what great would be. It's the same thing as with – the religion. I mean, because now, okay, and back to the Heaven's Gate group, they actually committed suicide thinking that they could catch a ride on a spacecraft that was behind the comet.
Help out. Correct.
Mm-hmm. I'm confused by that.
All right, so what happened here is they've been trying to get off the planet for 20 years, and at first this the UFO was going to hover mid-atmosphere and just sort of pick them up, and obviously it just didn't happen. So they were trying to find a way off the planet, and they had been hoping they'd receive some sort of marker that their time had come to leave, and the goal was always to physically get aboard it. But in 1985, Bonnie Lou Nettles, the co-founder, died. And when her body didn't go anywhere, they decided that her soul or her spirit or her consciousness must have transferred up. They came to embrace the walk-in concept, that she was basically a walk-in. She was an extraterrestrial being who had inhabited a human body, but then she returned to the next level. And at that point, it then became logically possible the rest of them might need to sort of abandon their bodies as well as an option. So slowly they began to embrace that idea that instead of the UFO landing or sort of picking them up in bodily form, they might leave their bodies behind and they would go in a spiritual consciousness form to outer space. And then with Hale-Bopp, what happened was there were claims that there was what was called a companion that was following the comet. So if you remember the old Art Bell radio show, Coast to Coast,
absolutely.
Yeah. So there was a caller who said, and some of your listeners probably know the story. There was a caller who said that he had documentary evidence, a photograph, that there was a UFO behind Hale-Bopp, that it was a NASA cover-up, and Art Bell supposedly saw the image and confirmed this. So there was all this buzz that indeed there was a UFO trailing Hale-Bopp Comet. And then there was a group of people from it was called the Farsight Institute that claimed they could astrally project their consciousnesses, and they claimed to actually see the UFO and to confirm its reality. And so they called into Art Bell too and said, "Yeah, we projected our consciousnesses. We've seen it. It's out there. It's a really big UFO. It's the size of a planet. It's following the comet." And some members of Heaven's Gate said, "This is it. This is what we've been waiting for. Here's our marker to leave." Some did believe that there actually was a UFO following Hale-Bopp. Others weren't sure, but they believed the time had come. This is what they were waiting for.
I missed the ride.
Well, yeah, according to them, we missed the ride.
So some of their practices, though, let's go back earlier into the conversation when you said that they were almost abandoning their humanity. I mean, they went so far as to self-mutilate.
Yes, several members were castrated. So part of what's going on here is they have to reject, they were taught to reject everything of the human level. So that meant anything which would bind you to our planet. Family, so they abandoned their families. Friendships, relationships, either romantic or platonic, were to be abandoned. Jobs, property, anything which mired you to this level. Drugs, alcohol, any of these things to be abandoned. By far the toughest for many members of the group was their sexuality, was the idea they had to be completely celibate. And there are different stories about how it came up, but several members decided they wanted to become castrated because this would be easier than having to deal with their urges. Not only were they not allowed to have sex, but they couldn't masturbate either. They had to be totally celibate, no sexuality. So several of the male members of the group said, let's get castrated. That might be easier. There are different stories about what happened. Different individuals claim they were the first person to volunteer. What is clear from the evidence we have is that several of the castrations were improperly done. This is not the sort of thing which you can just go to a doctor and say, take care of me. So they tried it themselves. They went to Mexico. It was a bit of a mess, and so they didn't all do it, just a few members, and they decided that it was not a project worth pursuing.
How did they actually kill themselves? Like, what is it that they did to kill themselves?
So what they did, and I'm going to preface this by saying I do not endorse suicide, and this is not a how-to. So, but as a historian, it is my job to say what actually happened. So with that preface, what they did is they bought a copy of a book intended for terminally ill patients about how to commit suicide, euthanasia, and they followed the advice in that book to a letter. What they did, and this is all, it's public knowledge, it's in the coroner's reports, which I've read, they killed themselves by overdosing on barbiturates combined with alcohol, which reduced their respiration, and then they tied plastic bags over their heads to basically suffocate. because they committed suicide in waves. There were three waves. The bags were not found over the heads of the first two waves because they were cleaned up. They were left sort of lying in state, basically. But that is the method. It was barbiturates, alcohol, and asphyxiation.
So they killed themselves in groups, in waves, you said. So in actuality, there was people that were still alive, so some would kill themselves and then they would clean them up or put them where they need it to be. And then, so they were all very aware of what was going on.
Very much so. Yeah, it was three waves, March 22nd through 24th, 1997. And, you know, it was a ritual suicide. So if you've seen the visuals, and it's pretty easy to just, you know, do a Google search, you can find a pretty easy access to the visuals. They were found lying in bunk beds in their full uniforms, their dress uniforms, with purple shrouds over their bodies. They were lying with their arms stretched beside themselves. They had their identification papers and glasses folded clearly next to each other to be easy to identify. But it was very much a ritual suicide. I mean, they were intentional about it. Obviously, I wasn't there, and no one who was there was able to tell us what happened. But by all accounts, it appears as if it was a calm procedure, that they knew what they were doing, and they chose to do it. You know, the image I've always had of it, if any of your listeners have ever seen, what was that movie? A Few Good Men, I think, where the army officer commits suicide, where he gets all dressed up and just sort of kills himself. You know, that sort of,
yes,
ritualized, you're doing it clean, you're doing it proper, you're doing it in the appropriate way, and then it's over. So I think that's what they did. They, you know, they got dressed up. They were wearing their uniforms. They put their affairs in order, and that was that.
And they even went so far as before this to make videos.
Yes.
Testimonials.
Yes. Most members of the group, nearly all of them, either video recorded a testimonial, an exit video, as they called it, or they wrote statements which were self-published in their book and later their website, explaining what they were doing and why. What the group then did is they compiled the videos. They were literal videotapes. They made an update to their website, and they sent all of this to several ex-members on whom they were good terms. And they actually timed it so it was dropped off at an overnight delivery service so it would arrive the morning after the last suicides. And they were very careful not to tell the ex-members what they were doing. They didn't want the ex-members to be held criminally liable for being aware the suicides were about to occur. So by the time their exit videos and the website updates and their statements had arrived into the hands of the ex-members, it was too late.
Now, what's this? One of the group members actually didn't commit suicide, didn't kill himself?
Well, there were several ex-members who were on good terms with the group, and you might be referring there to Rio D'Angelo, who was the person in the body. Yeah. Yeah, so Rio was a member who, at the time, he was basically still a believer, but he had left for sort of religious and personal reasons. And he's given an interview. It's easy enough to find. I think it was on LA Weekly where he talked about his experience. But he was one of the people who received the package announcing the suicides with the tapes and everything. He was the closest. I want to say he was in Los Angeles. He was somewhere nearby. So he drove down and found the bodies, and there's the 911 tape of him calling in to report them. Several other members also, or ex-members also received the tapes and such. Then there were two ex-members who later committed suicide ritually, who decided that although they were not part of the group at the time of the suicide, they were actually still believers, and they tried to commit suicide together as partners. One was successful, one was not, but then that second one later committed suicide. And there were two or three other ex-members who over the next decade or so also ended their lives, all for religious reasons, believing they were souls to get to the next level.
Yeah, but you've already missed the window. Why would they do it later? I thought they only had like a small window
hope. Hope. They hope the window is still open. And ultimately, if the next level, aliens are basically gods. Gods can do what they want. So they had hoped that the window was still open. Applewhite, the leader of the group, does say in one of his videos, one of the last ones he produced, that if you recognize his message, that the window may still be open. So he gives that sort of sense of hope that you might still have a chance. So that's probably what they were thinking about.
Wow!
Wow!
And now they had money on them as well. Was that about $5 or something and some coin?
Yeah, there was rolls of quarters and a couple of dollar bills. There's different explanations for this, and I've been told different things by various ex-members. One ex-member told me it was a joke that they actually did this just because they thought that it would get attention and this would be sort of a strange thing to do. Another member said that this was a holdover from when they used to go out. You know, so the group always lived together in sort of these little communal houses. But when they would leave, they would take money with for payphones. This was before, you know, cell phone technology. So they always carried some quarters and some bus fare in case they had to get back. So it was sort of a reference to the fact that when you leave the house or the craft, as they called it, you brought some money with. And they were leaving their house or their craft, so they brought their money with because that's what you do. That's probably the most likely explanation. There were other sort of claims as well, but the only people who know exactly why are no longer with us.
So you being into teaching and being a professor into religion, how has this sort of book and this work that you did on this affected you and maybe the way you teach or the way you talk about religion?
So I take religion really seriously as a force which can really lead to good or to evil, both in a broad sort of cultural, social sense, but also individual choices like the suicides. I think it's very, very powerful, and it's at the same time, the fact that people can and do believe and do so many different things makes me very hesitant to be able to say whose religions are crazy and whose are not, because as I mentioned earlier, from the outside, everyone's religions look a little crazy, and from the inside, they make sense. And what boggled me when I first began studying Heaven's Gate was that it made sense to them. Because when I first started studying it, I thought, this looks ludicrous. It looks like you add a bit of Star Trek to a bit of Bible to a bit of you know, shamanism, and here you go. And then after years of studying it, I began to understand why it made sense to them. And within their worldview, why it made sense. And it's actually really scary. It's really scary to say, I understand why this made sense to them. That is not a happy thought, to be honest. I'm not saying I believe them. I'm not saying I want to join them. I'm just saying I understand them. And that is in some ways tough because it makes them closer to us. It's really easy to say they were crazies. It's really easy to say they were brainwashed. It's really easy to say they were deluded fools. It's really easy to say they were nuts. It's a lot tougher to say, boy, they were like you and me. They just believed and did differently. And that's tough.
Now, cults as a whole, they seem to have a certain, for lack of better terms, a victimology. You know, and they like young, open-minded, idealistic people that are having personal issues that they believe they have an answer to. Having done this study and this research that you've done, do you kind of look over your students in a different way, or are you more aware of what's going on your campus?
I can't say I do, and the reason is the more I studied Heaven's Gate and the individual members who were part of it, the vast majority of them had been part of other alternative religious, spiritual, I might want to say cultic groups before they joined Heaven's Gate. They had been major parts of either particular organizations or they had been part of sort of the subculture. So this was not their first step into this alternative spiritual religious cultic occult world. It was particular sorts of people. There were very few members of Heaven's Gate who were sort of your ordinary average people uninterested in any of this before they met the group. There were a few. There were a few, one or two out of a group of 39. But most of them really had been on these spiritual quests for so long, this was just sort of their last stop on it. So in terms of, you know, what I think of in terms of, you know, my students who are in their teens and in their early 20s, when I teach on Heaven's Gate, because I teach a class, it's called Cults, Sects, and Communes. It says sex as in S-E-C-T-S. Cults,
Sects,
and Communes. Yeah, it gets the students in the door, though, right? I teach the class. Most of them look at the stuff and they say it's crazy. You know, it took a certain sort of person, I think, for any sort of alternative religious worldview to make sense. It's very much a niche sort of model, I think.
Are you aware of any new religious movements or groups or sex cults, whatever, that we should be aware of now?
Well, the ironic thing is that there's so many of them and they're so small that I haven't heard of any of them, particularly out where you are, because unless they do something to get on the national radar, they're just invisible. I know of smaller groups near where I am that one might, I suppose, plausibly call cultic in some ways. Most of them now often involve sort of gurus, you know, that's sort of the current sort of level of interest. So it would be a meditation master, some sort of yoga master that would have a class, and then there might be a group of people that might come to live with them and drop out of their sort of their ordinary lives to focus on this exclusively. You know, if you're a concerned family member, you might say this is a cult. If you are a member of the group, you'd say it was it's your life and it's your focus. And sociologically speaking, we know most members leave. Cults or new religions tend to have revolving doors. The best longitudinal or long-term studies show upwards of 75, 80, even 90% turnover rate over a 4 to 5 year period. So for many people, they come and go. But that isn't to say there's not that 5 to 10% that joins a group and stays.
Yeah. How do you feel about Scientology in being classified in this sort of way?
I don't know enough about Scientology to give sort of a proper educated academic opinion. I can tell you I know Scientologists who swear up and down that this is the most wonderful thing which has ever happened to them, and that this is meaningful, and that this makes perfect sense. And I can tell you I know people who are ex-Scientologists who say that it was the worst thing in the world and that it is it's the most evil organization you can imagine. I can tell you as an academic, I look at those two and I say, well, I'm not sure which one's right. It's probably somewhere in the middle. You know, my uneducated opinion on Scientology, without having studied it extensively, is that for your average Scientologist, your low-level member of, I believe they're called orgs, which are sort of the local groups, that it's probably just like going to a church or a synagogue. It's something they do occasionally. But that for those who are deeply into it, it becomes the center of their lives. And because there's a clear in and out, that probably leads to severe tensions. But again, that's an educated guess. I'm not able to give you sort of an informed opinion.
Wow. What have you got coming up next? Are you planning on doing more books?
Well, I'm always looking for new topics. So if any of your listeners know any particular groups they think I should take a look at, they can drop me an email. I'm easy enough to find on the Lake Forest College website. That's where I teach, lakeforest.edu. That's with an L. So if anyone knows any groups that they think would be worth taking a look at, you can drop me an email. As I said, the reality is most of these new religions are so small and so ephemeral. They come and go. I just try to keep my eyes and ears open in case there's something new which really calls for study, examination, analysis.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. So book, Religion, Food, and Eating in North America?
Yeah, that's the other one of my books. Yeah, you've done your homework on me. I love food. So that book, I co-edited with some colleagues looking at religion and food topics. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds good. I want to get that book and...
I think there's recipes in that one, but I will say I'm biased, obviously, being the editor, but it's a great compilation of academic studies of different religious groups as they relate to religion and food. There's one on a group out in your area it's a Native American group, and it has to do with their relationship with salmon and with salmon fishing and salmon-related practices. And that's one of the chapters in the book. So if you're interested, you can pick that one up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely. I guess I never thought about it till I saw the title of the book. But food has a lot to do with the religion that you're in.
Yeah, it does. It's deeply embedded. We don't tend to think about it except for maybe, you know, with Jews and kosher and Muslims and halal, we sometimes think about it because that's very public. You know, it's labeled in the supermarket or in the streets. But every religion has food teachings. Sometimes they're related to holidays or a rite of passage. Sometimes we think about them as cultural, but they're so deeply embedded, it's hard to distinguish between what is cultural and what is religious. Sometimes they're liturgical or ritual, you know, like the like a Eucharist, you know, a Catholic Eucharist. Sometimes they take place in the family at home, like Jewish Passover. Sometimes it refers to not eating food, like Ramadan fasting for Islam. Sometimes it's food offerings, like in Hinduism, with the offerings to the gods and goddesses. Sometimes it's what you do and don't eat. Some Buddhists are vegetarians, some are not. Yeah, obviously, we mentioned kosher and halal. Yeah, it's a fascinating set of materials. I love it. Yeah. Also, I love it. So when I studied, I get to eat it.
Yeah. Oh, Kevin would be good on that.
Yeah.
Wow. This has been really, really interesting. I've really enjoyed it.
It's always a pleasure to talk. You know, as a college professor, that's what I do. I love just sort of chatting with people about this. And, you know, it's there's so much in the world worth studying.
Oh, endless. Endless. Yeah. Well, we maybe we'll have you back on again. This would be great because especially about I was thinking of prophets and that sort of
idea. Great. Yeah, there's a lot we can talk about.
Oh, yeah. Well, our guest has been Dr. Benjamin Zeller, and the book we've been talking about is Heaven's Gate, and it's America's UFO Religion. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, it's been an honor. Thank you.
Yeah.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.